This is the House Finance Committee meeting. It is Thursday, April 22nd at 2:40 in the afternoon. Members who are present at this time, Representative Moses, Foster, myself, Terrio, Co-Chairman Mulder, Coring, Osterman, and Grusendorf. The first item I would like to take up today is House Bill 201, and then we will and hopefully get to final action on that bill today. Then we will take up discussion on and testimony on House Bill 200. It is not my intent to move the bill today. And House or Senate Bill 33 was not received by the committee, so that will be noticed for committee action sometime later. So with that, we do have the prime sponsor of the bill, Representative Norm Roseberg, on House Bill 201.
Well, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 201 is a Labor and Commerce Committee bill that was basically the result of a very recent court case. I believe you should have in your file a copy or a portion of a copy of the memorandum and order from Judge Weeks in the First Judicial District in the case of the Stuart Holland versus Holland American Lines and West Tours. Whereas the judge, Mr. Chairman, found the reading and interpretation of the statute on overtime in the state, which is 2310060B, to be apparently unclear, and therefore has, in spite of a attached affidavit from Commissioner Tom Cashin of the State Department of Labor, clearly pointing out the methodology of calculation of overtime, has indicated that the judge indicated the clear language said that the total calculation of overtime could include the 8-hour day, hours in excess of 8 hours a day in calculating the 40-hour week. In other words, you could potentially be paid twice for the same working hour if you look at the examples therein. In other words, if, for example, you worked 11 hours on Monday and got paid 3 hours of overtime and worked the balance of the week at 8 hours a day, according to this interpretation, you'll have a 43-hour week, so therefore you should get paid for the 3 hours of overtime for over 40 hours a week and 3 hours of overtime for the amount over 8 hours on Monday. Therefore, you got 6 hours of overtime instead of only three, and you actually only work 43 hours. So it's a double dip. It's called pyramiding, and I believe the judge's ruling is based on the language of the statute. Mr. Chairman, it goes without saying the impact of this case on all businesses throughout the state. It's absolutely necessary that this bill be passed. It has the full support of the administration. I would dare say probably every business in the state of Alaska. And it's absolutely necessary, and I thank the chairman for taking this bill up right away. We have with us a number of folks to testify, including Deputy Commissioner Perkins from the department. I've asked the drafter, Ms. Kramer, to come forward because there was a readopt of the CS and Labor and Commerce, but there's been further communication which requested a further clarification. I believe the committee has in hand a blank CS, which is version H, which has some minor corrections. So I've asked the draft to be available to handle any questions that relate to adoption of the version HCS by the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Roseberg? Representative Osterman?
Yeah, well, that was one of my questions, is which one we were getting at. You want to move?
Yes, we should have a motion to adopt the H version as the working document before us.
I'll move.
Is there objection to that motion?
Mm-hmm.
H version?
H. Addition on your desk. I got you.
It's on your desk. And Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, if I'd like to explain the differences, if the committee would draw their attention to the page 2 of both drafts, it's easier to see. Looking at the new H version, it's lines 19 and 20. And subsection 2, 40 hours a week. The balance of that subsection is deleted in the and then replaced with language in the H version. Formerly, it read, overtime compensation on this paragraph shall be paid only for those hours in which overtime compensation has not been paid under realm of this subsection. And the recommendation, I believe, is that it should be clear to the average working person, I believe all drafting should be, and then now would read, the number, 40 hours a week, the number of hours worked in a week under this paragraph shall be determined without including hours that are worked in excess of 8 hours a day. So rather than referring to the subsection that says 8 hours a day, I believe that's the differential. To make it absolutely 100% clear to the average legislator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a good bill, and I'm glad to see it. I'm assuming that the judge's action took place back in 1959. Why the retroactive date of 59? It doesn't say anything in your sponsor statement.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Perkins from the department accused me of choosing that effective date in terms of retroactivity. I said, why don't we make this go back to statehood? So he did. I do have Ms. Kramer here, and I would like to have her put something on the record about the retroactivity and any of her interpretations that the committee would want to hear from her.
Are there other questions for Representative Milberg at this time? Representative Williams?
How does this affect contracts, negotiating contracts?
In fact, Mr. Chairman, I believe, and perhaps Ms. Kramer could correct me, there is a contract issue in this case itself, so I believe that the overtime law would be take precedent unless they were a salaried type employee. I mean, that changes the calculation, and I could be wrong about that.
Okay. Hey, why don't we have the drafter come forward then?
Mr. Chair, I'm Terry Kramer from the Legal Services Division, and I'm the drafter of this bill.
Representative Williams just had a question about impacts on contracts.
Negotiated contracts? How would this affect the negotiated contracts, like union contracts?
I wouldn't think it would.
It would.
There's an exclusion, if I recall, in the overtime law for contracts, for arrangements of overtime, for flex time, in essence. And this doesn't affect that.
So if the union had in its negotiated contract the hours, anything after 5 o'clock, no matter what, if you worked only 2 days, anything after 5 o'clock would be...
This would not, I would think, affect that at all.
Yeah, that section of statutes is separate and
yes.
Kicks it into contractual law, basically. Then it's no longer, the overtime's no longer paid under the statutory framework. It exists under the negotiated contract.
And of course, you cannot as a legislature change the terms of a contract that's in existence. So even without saying so, we can't do that constitutionally.
Do you want to touch on the retroactive language?
Yeah, the retroactive section is section 3 of the bill, and the date is the date that the Wage and Hour Act came into being for the state. Basically, if the findings are right that this is how the act should have been interpreted all along and has been applied by the Department of Labor all along, then this retrospective clause will survive. If that finding is wrong, if in fact the law used to mean the way how it was applied in the case that's cited, Hallam versus Holland America, then if that was in fact the law, the retroactive clause won't have any effect because you will be. The issue is whether you are taking away wages that a worker has earned already. And so the decision about whether the worker has earned wages will also determine whether you can make this interpretation apply retroactively. I think that was confusing.
It was. Representative Davies.
I guess I'm concerned about whether we're creating some causes for action here that we should not get involved in. I mean, suppose somebody back in 1960 was paid under the Judge Week's interpretation, and then some employer decided to go back and get that money. I mean, I don't think that's very likely, but I mean, by passing the retroactivity clause, we would be creating a basis for that kind of action, wouldn't we?
I guess
my question is, why would, other than just some sort of theoretical consistency, why would we want to do this?
I think the court's recent interpretation potentially creates a lot of causes of action. And that's what the retroactive clause attempts to go back and prevent under the court's tortured interpretation of the statute. People back in the 1960s may be able to say, oh, well, I thought I was paid correctly, but now in 1999, a judge has indicated maybe under his interpretation back in 1960 I was paid incorrectly. And what we're trying to do basically is affirm the interpretation all those years of the way the statute read and was applied by the Department of Labor.
But it can work either way. And so what if that's what our concern is, why wouldn't we create some statute of limitations or something so that we just that no case could be brought, you know, more than 2 years after the fact or something like that?
Mr. Chair, there is in effect a 2-year statute of limitations.
Okay.
So that
so in
any case, you can't go back to this 1959 era. I don't know why that was what the request was. But.
Okay, so if there is a natural or an automatic 2-year statute, why do we go back to 59? Why does it say 59?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay. Any other questions from the drafter? If not, why don't we have Mr. Perkins come forward?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is Dwight Perkins. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor. Maybe to help clarify some of the previous speakers' concerns and some of the representative concern regarding Representative Williams, where there is a negotiated contract. This is the minimum wage an hour, minimum overtime at time and a half. If a labor contract calls for 2 times the base rate of pay for certain hours worked on Sundays or holidays, that's over and above. This is the minimum requirements to pay in overtime. In respects to Representative Davies' question about going back, as counsel has said, there is a 2-year statute of limitation for back wages. But the commissioner testified, Commissioner Flanagan testified on this issue yesterday in Labor and Commerce, and he had mentioned that for clarity's sake, just when the date established in 1959 of this, I mean, this goes back pre-statehood, but I think it was just clarity for the date of 1959. The department did not craft this legislation, so we don't know where that 1959 language came up with. But, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Labor, as Commissioner Flanagan testified yesterday in the House Labor and Commerce, does support this legislation. It will clarify the intent of the legislature and the Department of Labor, how we interpreted the overtime laws in this state for many, many years. It will take away the effect of what Representative Roper stated in that of what's called pyramiding, where an individual is paid for overtime's worked as they should be for over 8 hours a day, but in addition to that, they work for a cumulative total of 40 hours, but then again are paid for overtime for hours that were never worked. So the department doesn't feel that that's right, and the employer should not be harnessed with that burden to pay for some hours worked that were never paid. So the department does support this legislation and would ask that this committee support it as well.
Representative Bundy.
Well, thank you. I guess I need a little help understanding. As a person who one time worked in a pulp mill and got overtime for everything over 8 and overtime for everything over 40, maybe I'm a little hypersensitive, but in Representative Rookberg's example, he had Monday you work 11 hours, the rest of the week you work 8, and then this bill would allow 3 hours of overtime. My question is that if somebody works a
required to work 10 hours a day for 5 days, what is the overtime, according to this bill?
10 hours a day for 5 days?
Yeah.
The overtime would be 10 hours paid at time and a half.
You get 10 hours of pay for you get, and even though you've got 40 hours in Friday morning, that whole Friday is not counted as overtime.
Through the chair, Representative Lundy, if we worked, the example that you state is 10 hours a day for four days?
You get 40 hours.
That's correct.
And included in that is?
2 hours of overtime for each day.
8 hours of overtime.
Correct.
And under this new bill, then, Friday would be 8 hours of regular
no,
time?
No, it would not. It would be time and a half.
Would all day Friday would be time and a half?
No.
Not according to the bill sponsor.
Well, Mr. Through the Chair, Representative Bundy, I might have misinterpreted what your question was.
Some of us think that probably should be, but it's not.
So, Dwight, under the court's interpretation, if you worked the 1 day, you worked the 11 hours, so 3 hours overtime, and then 8 hours the rest of the week, was the court's interpretation that you got paid 3 hours overtime for the single day, for the hours overtime in the day, and you got to the end of the week, and oops, you worked over the 40 hours for the week, so you pay overtime again on the same 3 hours?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And so the example of 10 hours a day for 5 days, you'd get paid 10 hours worth of overtime for every two you went over eight, and then, oops, there's another section of statutes, you'd get paid again for the same 10 hours because they were in excess of
40.
That's
the pyramiding effect.
That's the pyramiding effect that we're trying to get away from.
Whether that's good or bad depends on whether you're receiving or giving.
Do you represent Foster and then Davies?
No, I was going over this court thing here. Maybe you've already answered it, but I'll ask it anyway. Well, what would preclude everybody in Alaska from going through court now and going back as far as he can to do the permitting?
Through the chair, nothing, Representative Foster.
Everybody in the entire state, contractors and bus drivers and truck guys and...
There is a potential for...
And they could bring it to court right now and collect...
Through the chair, Representative Foster, there is precedent set with this case, and that's why the department feels that it is necessary to take care of this, because there is an undue burden on the employer in this respect.
Except for that, we've had the testimony that there is a general statute of limitations that you can only go back 2 years.
That's correct.
So if we do want to clear up that problem, we need to at least have the retroactive portion go back to, say, January 1st of 1997. Or it could be April 1st, 1997. Just see. Representative Davies?
I think I understand pretty clearly what the intent is. I'm just not sure how to read the statutory language in front of me here. My first question is, there's an or in here. So it says employee is entitled to overtime for hours worked in excess of 1, 8 hours a day, or 2, the 40 hours per week. With this exclusionary thing, how is that interpreted? Is it the up to the employer or the employee to determine which one of those clauses is it, the larger or the smaller of the two? How does that?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, the interpretation that I believe we've used in the past is, if I'm employed by you, you tell me to work 10 hours today, and I come in tomorrow, and you tell me to work 6 hours, and then 8 hours the rest of the time, and then you tell me at the end, as my employer tell me at the end of the week, well, we're going to take the 10 that you worked on Monday and apply 2 of those hours to Tuesday because you only worked 6, and there, and then you don't get overtime. It's just all straight time. That is not fair. So that's where the and or the or comes into play, because some days you know if employee works more than 8 hours, then that employee, we feel, should be compensated for the time that it's worked, or 40 hours as it's running.
So it's up. So it's the larger of the two. In other words, up to the employee to choose which one of those clauses applies.
I wouldn't say it's up to the employee to choose. It's what's determined first. In the example I use, where they work over 8 hours a day,
Well, suppose, let me give you another example. Suppose they both worked over 8 hours a day and over 40 hours a week. In this example, they worked 10 hours a day, 4 days during the week, and then they worked two hours on Friday, say. So a total of 42 hours in the week. Is the employee entitled to 8 hours of overtime or 2 hours of overtime?
8 hours of overtime. Because those days, the days that they worked overtime individually would count as overtime hours.
So that's the way this is. That's where the statute is. Working. Now, if we went to the,
so this would be a 40.
Let's see. If we went to the other circumstance, okay. Well, I guess I wouldn't do that. Okay, forget.
Representative Davis, did you have a question? Representative Williams.
Yeah, sir.
Representative Foster.
Yeah, like we're talking 40 hours right here, but actually state employees are 37 and a half, aren't they? Like a DOT guy cleaning runways out in Nome on weekends, and he actually gets 40 hours. So, I mean, how would a bill cover different?
Well, through the chair, if I may, I believe that's under a negotiated contract, and negotiated contract, as Representative Terrio had mentioned before, if there was something that wasn't paid through that, then it'd probably end up in the courts.
So under that negotiated contract,
that's
what rules, the contract rules, and not this statute. Are there other questions for Mr. Perkins? If not, we have Pamela Bowell.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. I think I finally found an example that illustrates my question. In meeting section 2, 40 hours a week, without including hours of work in excess of 8 hours a day. Suppose you work Monday through Thursday at 8 hours and then you work Friday at 10. So your total for the week was 42. I guess it wouldn't matter in this example that you could pick it either way. But if you tried, what I'm worried about is when it says without including the hours that are worked in excess of 8 hours a day, the overtime for the week, the 2 hours for the week, it is also the 2 hours that were worked overtime over eight. And since I'm worried that you could read that without including those hours is excluding the two that were worked overtime on the eight.
Right. That's very good.
Representative Davis,
without including in the 40, so you could, because you'd have to exclude those two, you could only count 40. There would be no overtime the way I'm reading it, even though you work 42 hours in the week.
Mr. Chair, perhaps I could clarify.
Yeah. Come forward so the microphone picks up.
The or is intended to indicate that you don't have to have both kinds of overtime in order to get overtime. If you've got overtime in excess of 8 hours a day, you get whatever that is, time and a half. But when you go to look at the 40 hours a week, you've already been paid overtime for the 2 hours in your 10-hour day. So you don't count those 2 hours. You exclude the hours worked that were in excess of 8 hours a day when you're looking at the 40-hour eligibility. So if you work 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, and 6 hours on Saturday, you don't count the extra 2 hours on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday for which you've already been paid overtime under paragraph 1 because they were in excess of 8 hours. But you do include all of the Saturday hours, even though they weren't in excess of 8 hours, because they were in excess of 40 hours.
It's okay, John.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I've always kept a time card that shows your regular hours you worked on a day and your overtime hours you worked on a day. If your regular hours total over 40, those are overtime. And the rest, anything more than 8 hours a day is overtime. It kind of simplifies it. I'm sorry, I don't want to make it too simple.
I understand very clearly, I believe, what's intended. I'm just worried that the way we wrote it, I'm not sure that what's written down here is what I'm hearing people saying. That's why I'm just trying to get it.
President Davis, it seems like you're questioning whether there shouldn't be a clause that says whichever is greater.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That's or. Not necessary.
The or could be and, given the way the sentence is structured, the concern that was expressed to me when I was drafting it was that not to require both kinds of overtime before an employee was eligible.
And it might just be more clear if it were written exactly that way.
But I can see, though, 8 hours a day and over 40 hours a week. What if you just work 2 days, 10 hours a day? You're not over, if you put the word and in there, I can see that it would cause some confusion because you didn't have in excess of 8 hours and excess of 40 per week. So that could be equally confusing.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, we saw this amendment we got here today on this particular line. We have not had our legal counsel take a look at this yet, but if there is a concern, we'll address it downstream from this committee. As my commissioner likes to look at things very carefully, we reviewed this over the phone and didn't get really a chance to have our legal counsel take a look. I don't think it's going to be a problem. It reads proper to us. We, if there is a concern, we'll address it on the floor or some other spot, but I don't, the department doesn't feel at this point it's necessary to, you know, hold the bill over for any reason because of this language, and we'll address it in future hearings or on the floor, if you will, if there's a concern.
Do we have the specific date as far as retroactivity? Should we just go back sort of a generic two-year period or make reference 2 years from a certain date, a court decision date, or what? Because I guess it's fairly clear that we don't have to go back to 59.
You don't have to know.
Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any objection to modifying the date. Matter of fact, I rather offhandedly mentioned we ought to go back to statehood, and I guess several other people took it as my word, so they did. But I guess my only concern, I would rely on Ms. Kramer's opinion, is to make sure make sure the two-year limitation is, statute of limitations is adequate to bar any other cause of action that may come forward. So then the issue becomes, when is the effective date, and when the, if we only went back 2 years, would that be the court case or any other, would that be adequate? And I guess that's the question we should ask counsel. If we've made it effective as of the date of the court order and then 2 years backward, would that work? I don't know.
Terry.
Well, to the extent that this interpretation is the way the law should be interpreted now, yes, that would work. But if this is a change in law, then whatever retroactive date you pick is not going to stand. So, and if, on the other hand, if this is exactly how the Supreme Court would say the law should have been interpreted all along, we don't really have to have a retroactive clause. So pick a date you like.
Well, I think
2 years from the date of the Hallam case makes some sort of consistency sense.
Okay, are there other questions for any of the witnesses? Okay, fine. Now we'll get to Pamela Bowles.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pamela Bowl, and I'm president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And I don't want to have to try to explain what this says, but I know that my members, the employers in this state, are quite concerned that they would end up, under the interpretation of the law, paying over the same overtime hours twice. And so it's a very important piece of legislation to my membership. Prior to coming to this meeting, we had our chamber business roundtable lunch, and I advised those who were in attendance that this, most of them didn't even know about the court decision, and I advised them of the decision, and they were very concerned. But then when I said it was retroactive, there was a collective gasp as they all started thinking about how much overtime they have paid in the last couple years and the impact it would be if they had to now come up with double that, essentially. In many cases, it wouldn't always be that. But it is a very important issue, and we don't believe that it was ever the intent that it should be essentially triple time instead of time and a half.
Okay, and the the April 7th date, the effect of the court's, the effective date of the court's interpretation. Okay. Any other questions for Pam? Representative Foster?
Well, not for Pam. She said triple time on time and a half. I was trying to think. Isn't there like holidays where people get paid double time? So this is actually quadruple time on some certain days, isn't it? Like if a guy works on Christmas or Martin Luther King Day or some nationally recognized day off, I think you get double time for the time and a half.
Representative Moses?
Not according to the Wage and Hour Act. That's only contract, Joe.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Are there any other questions for the prime sponsor or witnesses? Representative Bundy?
Just a question for the sponsor. I understand the concern about the retroactivity, but if he'd entertain a motion to allow this to proceed from now henceforth, I would support the bill. Otherwise, I can't support the bill.
Okay. Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, if the committee wants to consider an amendment to make the retroactivity retrospective effect date to be 2 years and 1 day from April 7th, 1999, which is the date of the order, I would not look at that as hostile. That may make some more sense than
2 years back from that date.
I just use 2 years and 1 day back from the date of the court order, which covers the statute of limitation period.
Representative Bundy?
Mr. Chairman, that isn't, I guess, where I was going to go. I just said eliminate any retroactive obligation for employers, but from this day forward, anything more than 8 hours and anything more than 40 hours is overtime.
But do we want to leave, Representative Bundy, a window where people could make the argument that they should be paid twice for the same hour of work?
Yeah, anything more than 40 hours in a week. Overtime starts on the 40th hour. If you work
40th regular. Representative Bundy supports pyramiding.
Yes. I support pyramiding.
Okay.
Having been the beneficiary of that in my college days, I think
I will move.
Employers don't have to make people work that long.
No wonder they have budget problems.
Representative Mulder?
Mr. Chairman, I would move a conceptual amendment, the retrospective event, Section 3, or effect. Yeah, I was going to say have this effect take, is retroactive to April 1st, 1997.
Does everybody understand the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment passes. There is a 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Labor, Wage and Hour. Coincides with their current and longstanding interpretation, so they don't figure that it's going to trigger any expense. With that, are there any other amendments to come before the committee? Representative Foster?
You're ready to move it? Okay, I'll go ahead and move HB 201 out of committee with the attached fiscal notes in with individual recommendation.
Is there objection to the motion?
Yes, I will, and I'd like to speak to my objection.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, overtime does two things. It rewards a employee for time work. It also, overtime, destroys employees' weekends and evenings that they might spend with their family or better engaged in fishing or whatever. Employers have an option to ask people to work more than 8 hours or to work more than 40 hours. If it's not the employee's problem, if an employer can't schedule his work differently, and I don't think it's the employee's obligation to have their life manipulated by someone, and if they do, then they're going to have to pay a premium from my point of view. So I won't be supporting them.
But Representative Bundy, is overtime pay not enough of a premium?
Someone who's worked 7/12, no. Time and a half is not enough, no.
Representative Moses?
This is one reason why you can't force an employee to work overtime. Their option.
And other option is going hungry.
Okay, there is objection, so we will have a roll call vote.
Representative Moses.
Yes.
Representative Williams.
Yes.
Representative Osterman.
Yes.
Representative Bundy.
No.
Representative Davies.
No.
Representative Davis.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Grusendorf.
No.
Representative Corrin.
Yes.
Representative Terrio.
Yes.
Representative Mulder.
Yes.
8 yea, 3 nay.
The bill will move from committee. That brings us to the next item up, which is House Bill 200.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, I just couldn't stop myself.
I'm the telegram governor.
Just the heartless Republican bills.
I didn't really understand you.
Where's the bipartisan?
Hey, if somebody wants to use up my time, they're going to pay for it. And if I run into 40 hours, if I work 40 hours in 3 days, or 4 days or 5 days, anything beyond 40 hours, they're going to pay for it. And if anything over 8 hours, they're going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, schedule their work better.
Well, perhaps in Bundy, it is paid for in time and a half.
I know. They're going to pay again.
No problem.
Hey,
The wobbly spread.
I'd like to start the testimony on House Bill 200. We have a number of people on teleconference and here, and I believe that we have, first of all, Eddie Jeans with the Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm school finance manager for the Department of Education. I wanted to address the committee today because the department has some concerns about the CS for House Bill 200. It's my understanding that Steve Van Sant, the state assessor, is online, so if I misspeak, I'm sure he will correct me when he gives his testimony. First of all, I'd like to give you my understanding of how the full value determination is established. There are some exemptions in Title 29 that are mandatory and do not count in the full value determination. Then there are some exemptions that are optional in Title 29 that do count in the full value determination. The reason I point that out to you is we have a system that uniformly determines the real and personal property within each community across the state of Alaska. It's a uniform process. Under House Bill 200, there's a Section 1 amends Title 14.17.5.10 and basically says on page 2, I'll read the language, says, however, the value of the property exempted under 2945.050I may not be included in the determination to the extent of the exemption. What this bill does is it amends Title 2945.050I, where there is currently a $150,000 mandatory exemption, and makes it an optional exemption, either wholly or partially. In other words, it leaves it up to each community to determine what level that they're going to exempt. The Department of Education has a problem with this being exempted from the full value determination for the purpose of calculating state aid under the foundation program, because then we have a different rule being applied in each community, and it does not reflect the community's ability to actually pay for their education services. The full value determination is what we apply the four mills to in determining each school district's local contribution rate. So the Department of Education does have a problem with this piece of legislation. We believe that if you were to put some parameters on it, mandatory exemption of 150, but optional beyond that, and the mandatory is still utilized in determining the full value, that would be fine with us. But this having a different rate from each community based on how that community votes is basically a disequalizing factor. It doesn't treat all communities the same.
I guess I'm not quite sure why, because they get to choose
the level of the exemption. And what this legislation would do is, based on what level that each community determines, say a community determines that they want to exempt $500,000 of property for 65 years of age or older, then their assessed value would be reduced by that $500,000 for each person in that community. Another community may not exempt anything. So then their property value would have that $500,000 that was exempted in the other community included in their property value. What we're looking for here is a uniform application of determining what the full value determination is for foundation funding purposes.
Representative Davies.
Mr. Jeans, what if we just took out that language up on the top of page 2? Just I guess what I'm getting at is why just couldn't we get to a point where there was the full and true? Why couldn't we just separate these issues? You have one mechanism for determining the full and true assessment of the community, and then just disentangle that from the question of whether there's a senior property tax exemption or not. Wouldn't that address your concern?
Mr. Chairman, I have talked to Steve Van Sant, the state assessor, about this issue. Because this is a mandatory exemption right now, and the initial version of this bill made it an optional exemption, the value of the communities around the state would go up because we don't consider those optional exemptions. Under Mr. Van Sant's calculations, I believe he determined that the increase required local effort, because this becomes an optional, not a mandatory exemption, would go up approximately $6 million statewide. So whoever Mr. Van Sant was working with on this bill didn't want the required local effort to go up. So they came up with this approach of, we'll do an assessed value for the Department of Education for the purpose of calculating state aid, and then we'll do our other assessed value, which gets published in Alaska Taxable and used for other purposes. So in essence, the state assessor would be doing two assessed values.
And that is, that's the way it is written here in the CNRA?
In the CNRA amendment, that's my understanding.
Representative Davies?
Just to make sure I'm reading this right. So if we assume that the we remove the mandatory requirements, and then from that point of reference, if a community then were to vote to enact a senior property tax exemption, that would have the effect of reducing their revenues from the senior property source or property tax from seniors, but increasing the revenue from the state in terms of state aid education?
Through the chair, if they...
So would it just exactly offset that?
If they voted to pass a tax exemption that was greater than the current 150, then their state aid would actually go up. Their required local effort would go down by that amount that they've exempted beyond the current $150,000. So there would be a fiscal note up, you know, to the local community.
The impact on state aid, though, through the education formula, it wouldn't be dollar for dollar, though, would it?
Mr. Chairman, no, it wouldn't. It would be the formula equivalent of whatever the change is.
So the local community would lose more in property tax value, property tax income, than they would gain from the education formula.
Mr. Chairman, that may be correct. I couldn't really speak to that.
If the 150 weren't in there, though, that would be dollar for dollar.
No, it's impacted because the local contribution is four mills,
right?
Not the entire amount,
right?
Okay, are there other questions for Mr. Jeans? Carl?
If you have an assessment at a certain value, just because a senior citizen applies for an exemption, it shouldn't. I don't understand why it changes the total assessed value.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moses, I'm sure Steve Van Sant will speak to that, but in determining the full value determination of each community, there are some exemptions that are mandatory under Title 29, and those properties are not included in the full value. So, but there are optional exemptions. Those are included in the full value. I believe boats and cars are an optional exemption. But in determining the value of the property within a community, the assessor does not consider whether or not they have a local exemption for those vehicles or boats. You count the value of the vehicles and boats statewide. If your community opts not to tax it, that's your community's choice. But it is a reflection of your ability to pay.
So this might be a question for Mr. Van Zandt. So in Fairbanks, where we have no property tax on boats and cars, how does Mr. Van Zandt or the department estimate what that valuation is?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. Mr. Van Sant could answer that question.
Very good. Are there other questions for Mr. Jeans? Okay, seeing none, why don't we go to the teleconference to Mr. Van Sant while this confusion is fresh on our mind. Steve Van Sant, are you online? Okay, first of all, could you answer my last question, how you estimate the value of basically personal type property in communities where they do not assess a tax on it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will. But first, with respect to my name, Steve Van Sant, State Assessor with the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. To answer your question, Mr. Chairman, we get a listing of all motor vehicles from the Department of Motor Vehicles each year, and we assign a scheduled value to different categories of motor vehicles, whether they be automobiles, trailers, tractors, motorcycles, and then we apply that schedule uniformly throughout the state. The schedule was built back when we had many jurisdictions that did assess those properties, so we feel comfortable. We're conservative on our value for that, but we feel comfortable with it, and it is applied uniformly throughout the state. As far as other types of personal properties, we also build schedules based on other municipalities that levy that do assess those types of property. We do it basically on a per capita basis, whether it's in a hub area or whether it's in a remote area. So we built different schedules and we apply them throughout the state. So I hope that answers the question.
Okay, so in Fairbanks, then you calculate that value, but then I guess it gets applied all against the property tax. Is that correct?
We calculate the value out, Mr. Chairman, and it is used for the full value determination. It is used for your school funding local contribution requirement. The formulas is applied to both real and personal property, just as the same as it is in Anchorage or Matsu, Kenai, Kodiak, wherever it may be. So we call it equalizing the value, where everything, the full value should reflect everything that could be taxed should a municipality decide to tax it. Mr. James is right. In fact, he did a very good job of explaining it. Too bad there's a hiring freeze on it. Wish we had opening for him here. But full value is supposed to reflect the value that the municipality could tax should they decide to tax, if they choose to exempt certain pieces of property. And we do have under 2945050 several categories of property that can be what we call optionally exempted. Those were added back into the full value. The mandatory exemptions under 030, such as churches, schools, cemeteries, hospitals, senior citizens currently, and disabled veterans, are excluded from that full value determination, so there's no formal equivalency required for local contribution to school there. This bill would move this out of mandatory exemption into the optional exemption. When I was asked for a fiscal note on the effects of the bill, obviously from the state point of view, from our department, there was a zero fiscal note. However, we also pointed out that it would cost local municipalities an additional $6 million based on the 4 mil equivalency of the effect of moving from a mandatory to an optional exemption.
Okay. Are there other questions for Mr. Van Sant? So the local contribution calculation, it comes up with a dollar amount, doesn't it, for the local community?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So, and then if they don't apply the, if they don't tax the full valuation, then those properties that do pay a tax end up chipping in a little bit more to make up the difference for the non-tax property.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Learn something new every day. I don't own a boat, but I pay for somebody else's boat.
Might as well have one.
Mr. Chairman, just one clarification. The full value determination really has nothing to do with the taxes on those items of personal property. What it does do, though, is it is used in the calculation of your local aid for your local contribution for school aid. It has nothing to do with the mill rate as far as whether personal property is included or excluded there. The only time you would see that is if nobody in Fairbanks paid personal property taxes. If you lived in a municipality like Mat-Su, for example, where they have exempted certain categories of personal property, that burden is shifted to other members, taxpayers, who do have personal property which is taxable. For example, they exempt the first $200,000 or $250,000 worth of business inventory. That throws off the mom-and-pop taxes on that to the Cars, Safeway, the Walmart, and it's just a shifting of the burden. In Fairbanks, you've shifted the entire burden of personal property to the real property taxpayer.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? If not, why don't we go to Fairbanks, Richard Bouse, and then we will go to Kodiak to take Pat Branson. Mr. Bouse, are you in Fairbanks?
That's correct, I am. I'm more or less observing, but I do have a few questions. What I heard Mr. Van Zandt say about the burden being shifted to the taxpayer base for the elders that do get the credit, is that correct?
No, I think that discussion, I sort of got us off on a tangent there. It was the burden that would be paid on personal property. That's the boats and other things that that people own. And he talked, I believe, about a shift of from that to the property tax payers.
And that was not, you were not talking about real property or real estate?
That was a discussion of shifting that burden from real, from personal property to real property, real estate.
Well, I guess my main concern is, and I'm represent the Nakanaga Elders Organization in Fairbanks. We work with 42 villages in the interior. Many of the elders relocated to Fairbanks over the years and are still doing so because of the cost of living and some of these benefits, with the property tax exemption being one of them. They're living on a very fixed income. Every opportunity they have to save some money. I do know of a few elders that invest that tax money. They take half of what they would have had to pay for their taxes and invest it in an IRA. And over a seven-year period, if it have amassed some retirement. For the folks, if they were have to pay their property taxes, obviously they wouldn't be able to invest any longer into their retirement accounts or whatever they chose. I'm wondering how this is all going to affect that.
Well, that's a good question. Then, if the option is made, then that I would imagine would be something that would be discussed at the local level.
And again, I'm wondering why we're putting the burden on the local entities. Does it involve getting funding from the state if they do decide to tax, they get more funding through the state. If they don't decide to tax, they get less. Is that the simple part of it?
No, it's not really tied to an increase or decrease of state funding. It would just be purely a local option.
And what would make the local entities want to continue this option? Where would the interest be there?
Well, they may factor in or could factor in just some of the information that you just testified to.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask, and I don't know about Fairbanks and whether they choose to continue an exemption or not, but I would just ask the gentleman, why would the state want to continue the exemption if local people wouldn't?
Well, that's a good point, and I don't know, but I do know one thing, that the state and Fairbanks and I assume Anchorage are with this focus on the older Americans. and especially older Alaskans, we've been giving lip service to these folks for a long time, but yet they're the ones that seem to be hitting the pocketbook all the time. And I'm just really curious. This is going to create some hardships to folks that I know personally, and I'm just wondering what safety measures or what kind of options we have available to us if this, in fact, does come about and Fairbanks, because of lack of funding, has to tax all properties.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you like, we're all faced with many options. I would certainly disagree that the state has been unduly harsh on older population. I think you'll find that we've been quite generous, and the older population is growing dramatically in Alaska, in part in reaction to that, I think.
That's very correct, and I agree with you there, but if we stop offering services or benefits to these seniors, what's that going to do to them? It may reduce their longevity. It may put them at undue risk of financial dilemma, even.
Mr. Bass, I know in the Hess budget, that's part of the problem, is trying to keep up with the demand for Pioneer services, Pioneer facilities, Alzheimer's services, senior respite services. And I think if you look back over the past couple of years, we have been pretty generous and tried to bite the bullet as much as we can and steer money in those directions.
That would be my comment to behoove you to continue trying for our elders, because the more of them that go, the more stories and more traditions we lose.
Okay, are there other questions for Mr. Baus? Next we'll go to Pat Branson in Kodiak, and then we'll go to Ketchikan and take Joseph Craig. Ms. Branson, are you in Kodiak? Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Branson had... was on a different...
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
My name is Pat Branson. I'm director of the Senior Citizens of Kodiak. And this bill concerns me in that you are moving this property tax exemption to a local level, whereby local municipalities would be allowed to eliminate the exemption. With many of the municipalities being forced to cut services and raise taxes with other bills that are being offered in the present legislature, the responsibility of the legislature in assuring seniors, Alaskan seniors, an affordable place to live is being shifted to local municipalities. Having balanced communities with young and old in Alaska is most important. To not only allow but force local communities to discontinue the senior property tax exemption, I understand that would be an option, is really not acting in a responsible manner. Shifting responsibilities, especially without having reviewed a long-range fiscal plan, is really not an appropriate or fair way to conduct business. We want to keep our seniors in this state, and this bill would hurt Alaskan seniors and communities as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Branson? Okay, also, let's see, in Kodiak, do we have Margaret Hall?
And she doesn't want to speak, but Carlson would like to speak.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, if you go ahead.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. I'm here as the assessor for the Kodiak Island Borough. Obviously, I'm in favor of allowing a local option and the ability to tailor the program to the local needs of the community. The biggest problem I've had over the years is kind of a statewide application. And I know it's very difficult for you at the state level to tailor a program to local communities, so I feel that it would be an asset in the sense that we could go ahead, take the existing revenues that we have to deal with, and work with a senior citizen and needy population to go ahead and ensure that their needs are met. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Davis?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, how much is this state mandate costing the city and borough of Kodiak?
Currently we have, off the top of my head, about $23 million in assessed value against the $700 million roll. Our current mill levy is about 9.25 mil, so that would generate approximately about $400,000, I believe, $200,000 a year, and we collect about $6.8 million. So it's about 10%, I believe, at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next, then, we will go to Ketchikan and Joseph Craig.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Finance Committee, am I coming through okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm here today with Mr. Bob Weinstein, the city mayor, and Mr. Jim Van Horn from the borough, but I want to address the Bill 200 in regard to veterans. Veterans are getting a strong message that our representatives are looking to save funds that have not been funded to municipalities since 1985. It is estimated that roughly 500 veterans would be affected by municipalities if municipalities place their property back on a tax roll. A $150,000 tax credit in Ketchikan represents over $2,000 that a 50% disabled veteran would have to accumulate if their property is placed back on the tax rolls. Surely this would become a hardship to many of these veterans. The veterans population in the state of Alaska is the second largest per capita of all the United States and is reported to be between 65 and 70,000. All of the programs except the service officer funding that provides any monetary value to veterans in Alaska have been rescinded over the years. In all fairness, I sincerely request that you reconsider this piece of legislation. Pitting young voters against seniors and veterans by vote could have a profound consequences on local communities in Alaska. That's all I have in the way of comments, but Bob Weinstein would like to say a few words as well as Mr. Van Horn.
Okay, next I've got Mr. Van Horn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Van Horn. I'm on the Ketchikan Gateway Borough here in the Ketchikan Borough Assembly. Just one question. We have on our ordinances a like ordinance that exactly mirrors 2945030. The language of the proposed legislation says the municipality may be made by ordinance approved by the voters wholly or partially exempt from taxation, assessed value, et cetera, et cetera. My question is, do we, since we have something already on the books, it's been there since 1986, is that made mute, and do we have to go back to the voters to get something on the books, or would ours be maintained since it is a borough ordinance? That's my question to the committee. As a veteran myself, I echo Mr. Craig, at the same time as a member of the Borough Assembly and a board of director of the Alaska Municipal League, I'm in a position where I can understand how the city governments throughout the state have been working with this problem for years. Here in Ketchikan, it represents about $700,000 per year. And with that, I'll just finish off and have Mr. Weinstein say something if he wants to ask some questions.
Well, Mr. Van Horn, has your borough attorney given you a legal opinion on the issue of whether your local ordinance would have to be validated again by voters?
No, he hasn't. I just tried to get a hold of him just when we first started the hearing here, asking that exact question, but he's on another conference. But when we get through here, I'm going to go right down there and talk to him about this.
Okay. I may have my staff get in touch with you to find out what that determination is. I don't believe up in the Fairbanks North Star Borough we have a separate ordinance. At least in discussion with our attorney up there, this hasn't been raised as an issue. So I would like to know if it is an issue in your community.
Appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
And next we'll go to Mayor Bob Weinstein.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Bob Weinstein, mayor of the city of Ketchikan. And while today the city council hasn't considered this legislation, we haven't had a meeting since its introduction, I can say that for reasons mentioned by Mr. Craig, there hasn't been overwhelming support at the city level to repeal the exemption for senior citizens nor for disabled veterans. I won't repeat the comments that were made. I will say that if the intent is, I understand it,
is that there be a local option. Section I needs some clarification and possible amendment. It appears that what this bill would do would be to require an election if, for example, the city of Ketchikan wished to continue the status quo, i.e. the exemption for disabled veterans and senior citizens. We do not have a parallel ordinance since the state statute would preempt it in any case. So I would suggest that consideration be given to changing that section to require an election if a municipality wishes to change the status quo, not to set up a possibly contentious election if, in fact, the municipality is not interested in the change. Alternatively, I would also suggest that, especially for a home rule city such as Ketchikan, that the issue be left up to the local elected body, as there are other matters of taxation, both property and sales tax, which are not, again, preempted by state statute. My final comment is, I guess it's more of a question. If I heard the comments from the assessor, Mr. James, correctly, there was some concern that inadvertently by switching from a mandatory to optional exemption, that would cost those municipalities which have property tax an additional $6 million in terms of their state education aid. And my question is that corrected by the amendment that came out of Community and Regional Affairs in Section 1, or does that still need additional correction?
Yeah, I believe the testimony from Mr. Jeans was to the committee substitute, so I think in their interpretation it still is a problem that needs to be addressed or clarified. So that really is the...
I would certainly urge support of so that property tax-paying communities do not lose $6 million in school aid, since I'm sure that's not the intent of the committee in terms of HB 200. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next, we'll go to the Mat-Su area. First, Frederick Stern, and then Lorraine Montgomery. Next, we'll go to Lorraine Montgomery and then Minnie Fisher.
Thank you. I make less than $700 a month with Social Security and long term. And if this goes through, I will have to leave my home because there's no possible way that I can pay the taxes. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Minnie Fisher? Next, we'll go to Valdez and Ellis Fall.
Hello, this is Ellis Fall and Valdez.
go ahead.
Yes, it seemed like after listening to a lot of this is bookkeeping and funding issues. In other words, the different departments trying to figure out how much money and so forth for schools, etc. And if they were to remove the mandate that requires municipalities and even make it optional, as one person mentioned, that they have to have a vote. You also have a lot of very greedy municipalities or communities or whatever that want to get every dime they can get. And if you remove this exemption, you're going to have a lot of people that are, cannot afford their to live where they're at. I mean, they work all their life to pay off a home, and maybe when they get down and have a fixed income and don't have income other than Social Security and maybe retirement, there isn't that much money, and you're going to change something, which means all of a sudden it's going to jump higher. I mean, our medical insurances are going up. Our other just plain taxes going up. And plus your other expenses. But retirements are nothing else. Sometimes go down as a person gets older. And then you have the veterans issues. The fact that these veterans are living here, and they're on a limited disability income. It's not going to go up if you take away this exemption for taxes to cover this. They're still limited. It's going to force people to sell out, possibly, and then they're going to be going and looking for state housing, which is going to cost the state, or Pioneer Home, and where is the money going to come for these places? It seems like you need to keep these mandates in there because you do have the greedy communities. And that's about all I have to say in just a moment.
Hey, Mr.
I think that's covered. I'm not yet 65 to where I can file for it. I am retired, but I was planning on living here until I could. And I want to thank you for letting me speak and say what I can to make this exemption from taxes stay on the books.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fall. Now, is there anyone else on the teleconference network? Okay, I will come to Juno here. We have a number of people. Why don't I start with Kevin Ritchie?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League. And on behalf of the Municipal League, we do support the concept, the passage of House Bill 200. We are working with staff to take care of some of the issues that you've heard about today. Obviously, municipal governments would not be benefited by essentially paying an additional $6 million for schools, and we know there's a solution to that, and we're certainly willing to work with you on that. And the we're also concerned that the broadest possible discretion to work with seniors and veterans to design a program be allowable under the law. For example, some of the things that we have heard over the years municipalities talk about is not the elimination of the exemption, because obviously, as you heard today, a number of people depend on that exemption, and that's part of their support for their ability to live in Alaska, at least as comfortably as they do. But some of the things that have been discussed is right now, according to the state assessor, the average exemption is a little bit over $100,000, whereas the mandatory exemption is up to $150,000. and that amount has been growing over the years. So one way to slow down the growth of the cost of the exemption that we've had heard discussed is to cap that amount at some other number than $150,000. Another option has been to make it needs-based. You know, obviously, if a senior has plenty of income and doesn't need the exemption, it may be something discussed in the community that would limit the cost of this exemption. And last is the possibility of deferral. For example, you might have a mandatory or an exemption for everybody up to a certain amount, say $75,000. This is just all conjecture. And then have an optional deferral of taxation over that amount, meaning that during the life of the senior that they would not have to pay property taxes up to whatever that deferred amount was. So there's, and you can mix and match those in a variety of ways. That's why we would ask for a broad discretion. And with that, I just want to thank you and would be happy to answer any questions.
Other questions? Representative Foster.
Yeah. How do you take a position? Do you have a meeting of the mayors and then you guys all vote on a certain platform? Or, you know, not so much this issue, but any issue?
Mr. Chairman, interestingly enough, this issue has been before the Municipal League for 9 years probably, certainly before I was here, and positions have been established. This year was not a bill that we had on our primary platform, so we're having to play a bit of catch-up, but traditionally the Municipal League has supported this concept.
When was the last time you would have voted on it then, probably?
The vote on the last position would have been in the year before this, 1997.
How many members do you have?
140.
Do you remember what the vote was?
It was a consensus position.
Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, Kevin, do you know what the statewide impact is?
Yes. Through the chair, it's, this actually is all out of the Alaska taxable, which Mr. Van Zandt puts out each year. But the statewide impact is approximately $24 million.
And I think Representative Moses and I would probably want to know, would a community development fund help this situation?
Yes.
he never misses an opportunity. Are there other questions? Representative Davies.
The number you quoted, the $24 million, is would assume that every community got rid of the exemption.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. One thing I forgot to mention, which is really critical. While at this time, if every community got rid of this exemption, it would allow the taxation of a little bit over $24 million to occur, there are some communities that it would not benefit or it couldn't benefit. Anchorage, for example, because they have a revenue cap rather than a tax cap, so it's shifted around. But by far most important is that no community we know of has considered eliminating this exemption as one of the options. Those options that I discussed were ways that would make it more controllable. But right now, the cost of this exemption has been going up by $2 to $3 million per year as property values rise and as more people get older. So controlling the increase is much more likely a result than saving any money in particular. Having been a city manager and worked with an assembly, I would be extremely surprised if any assembly or council in the state fully eliminated or even significantly eliminated this exemption.
Representative Davies, follow up?
Yeah, if the communities didn't get that, then what? Have you got some number that you expect for the impact? I mean, my original statement, I think, is correct, that it would require everybody to get rid of it for that total amount of money. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So what do you anticipate the impact is in fact going to be?
Through the chair, according to Mr. Van Zandt's annual tabulation, this exemption has grown from $17.5 million. I mean, the cost of it, the full cost of it statewide. For example, in 1990, it was a little over $6 million statewide. In 1997, it was $20.3 million. 1998, it was $22.3 million. And in 1999, it was $24.6 million. So it's growing at a rather astounding rate. Most of the things that I've mentioned, if applied, would likely slow down the rate of that growth, but not reverse it. And that's not a scientifically, that's not, I mean, that's just a an evaluation, not a calculation.
Representative Davies.
Two other questions, if I may. One, do you have a position on whether the effect of this should be a mandatory, would have a mandatory requirement for a new vote by the people in the municipalities, or would there be some kind of, would you support some kind of grandfather clause that would, that if an existing ordinance were on the books and they didn't want to change it, that it could stay on the books?
Mr. Chairman, that's one issue that I can't give a position on right now. Frankly, we had not, this bill has obviously just been in its present form for a pretty short time. The issue that Mayor Weinstein brought up upon reflection is a very valid issue, in that I know that Kenai has an exemption that's an optional exemption right now over $150,000, and Mayor Weinstein said Ketchikan did as well. So if the action was to abolish the exemption on the state level, then there would only be left an exemption over $150,000 in those two communities, and that's something that probably should be, well, it has to be considered, but I don't have an answer for that right now.
It's my understanding, staff called and talked to our legal, that passage of the bill wouldn't necessarily eliminate or override a local ordinance that's already in place and been voted on. But as you mentioned, if you have an exemption that's up to 150 for the state and they have put on top of that, you know, an optional, if you then take away the state one, you would, in fact, perhaps, without going to a new vote or new mechanism at the local level, you would only be giving a tax break to very wealthy seniors, and a more moderate income senior that perhaps had a house that was under the 150 may get nothing. So I don't think our action necessarily, it doesn't overrule or eliminate local ordinances, but when you have some results that wouldn't make sense, the local government may then choose to refigure, looking at the full slate of options again, and redo their local. Okay, let's see, I think Representative Foster had a question, then Williams.
Yeah, $25 million, you say it costs municipal taxpayers every year. I'm trying to figure out what a percentage, like what's the total amount of tax revenues for all the municipalities. Like I've got Nome and 29 villages. Obviously, the villages don't tax. The only one that I've got would be in Bushwask. Would be probably Nome, huh?
Yes. I mean, first class city.
Yeah. So what percentages of the whole here is 25 million?
Mr. Chairman, if Steve Van Zandt's still on the line, he's got it in his book.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out, like, is this substantial or is it insignificant or?
Mr. Van Zandt, are you still on the line?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am, and I'm not sure I quite understand the question.
Of what part is the $25 million a factor of? What percentage of the whole is it?
I don't have my book in front of me, but as I recall, the statewide property tax collection for 1998 was, I think it was $350 million, not counting the oil and gas property tax.
So it's about 7% then, huh? How about this right here on the second page? Maybe you touched on this municipalities with a tax cap. I know we chatted about this the other day. Like Fairbanks, this, if you pass this or didn't pass it, it wouldn't have any effect, right?
Through chair, yes.
So basically, we're just talking about maybe Anchorage or Ketchikan or like Juneau or Kodiak or something here, huh? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, Mr. Ritchie?
In a sense, this is more towards a long-range financial outlook for municipalities than it is an immediate fix. Would this replace revenues, lost revenues, that are currently facing municipalities this year? No. In terms of controlling the cost of this, there's probably a lot of rearranging that's going to have to be done in the tax schemes of the state, obviously, as well as municipalities. So using this as a tool for the future is maybe a better way to look at it than any kind of immediate savings.
Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to think. You know, I know many years ago when I first got on this committee, it was an issue. I think it's the same bill, huh? Eileen McLean, back in 92 or so, 93? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I've been here since 96, and we've had probably four bills that...
And they never get anywhere, do they?
Not yet.
Yeah. Hey, Representative Williams?
Yeah. You talk about rearranging. You know, I appreciate that. And, trying to figure out where the money is going to come from, but could you imagine what the seniors are thinking about now? How they're going to rearrange and what type of feelings are? During these 9 years that AML has been looking at this, have you looked into the laws that affect the seniors and how, you know, there's laws that, you know, you can't just affect them negatively in any manner. Would this come under any laws that the federal government has right now?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question. I mean, would there be any federal laws that prohibit the state from doing this, or?
For instance, you know, we have this law that the seniors have been accustomed to. Now, you take that away, they're going to have to rearrange their life. Now, there's laws in the federal government saying that you can't do that to seniors.
I see.
Okay, is there any, would this affect the seniors under federal law?
Through the chair, no. What I did testify was that, to my knowledge, there's no municipality that has talked about doing what you said, eliminating this exemption or significantly reducing it. Over the years, the discussion that I've heard has been finding ways to control the growth of it, which might be a needs-based test. For example, if I were a senior with this exemption, but I still had an income of quite a bit of money each year, that I might not get this exemption. So from that standpoint, I don't know of any federal law that would prohibit this from going forward, but there's obviously practical considerations, exactly as you said, that if this exemption were not here, some seniors very likely couldn't live in Alaska.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, if AML isn't suggesting right now that we do away with it, the cities are all supportive of this. Okay, and this bill is before us saying that we're going to take it away and leave it up to the communities. You know, just listening to the seniors today, and we have some more here, I'm sure that they feel very threatened by what we are trying to do here today.